Matthew Ball, thanks for coming on the Tech Meme Ride Home experience. The book, I'm going to say this real quick. Everyone knows this, but the book is The Metaverse and How It Will Revolutionize Everything with Matthew Ball. Chris and I both have copies. It's an amazing book. Matt, aside from thank you for coming on, let me just say this real quick. You're maybe the most quoted person on my podcast. Maybe Mark Gurman has been quoted more. But I first knew you as the guy that made me understand Netflix and the streaming wars and the MVU and all that stuff. I'm just curious, is there something about that sort of thinking that led you to thinking about the metaverse? Like, is the metaverse in a structural sense, like, is there some sort of like narrative, like storytelling thing that maybe prepared you for thinking about this stuff?
I wouldn't say that there was a narrative element, but, you know, more broadly, I see let me take a step back. My career started in deep tech. I was actually focused on oil and gas and aerospace and defense technology. And that was deep, highly technical, primarily focused on industrial applications. After that, I moved to the early mobile app economy, helped a number of different major film studios, book publisher, radio and terrestrial broadcast companies shift to digital, rights acquisitions, and so forth. I worked for Peter Chernin, where we built, bought, developed, and scaled early direct-to-consumer digital media and community companies. And then I moved to Amazon, which operated the world's second largest video service and probably the most sophisticated orthogonal business model. None of those directly led to the metaverse, but I do think in hindsight, they were the template for this convergence of many, many different technologies and certainly practiced my like nonlinear thinking about what could be and how.
When you say template, though, like, I think this is actually very interesting. And I've listened to many of your interviews recently. I listened to a lot of the things that you published previously. I've read, rather. When you're talking about like these military applications, when you're talking about online communities, when you're talking about, you know, being at Amazon and working on these universes, as I think Brian is alluding to, I do see a kind of through line where each of those different verticals or spaces or structures do kind of lead to this place where you want to integrate all of those things kind of into one context, into one container. One of the things that I've noticed about you is how you tell stories. So to what degree is the metaverse kind of a great unraveling of almost the story of your experiences? And how much of this is sort of, you know, the sum total of your lived experience versus like there's going to be many, many more big technology, epochs, and this is just one more step along the way?
So that's a great question. I mean, I certainly wouldn't define the metaverse as the sum total of my experiences, but I do think that the degree to which I was prepared to work in this space is the sum total, because I see that as deep tech, as business model transformation, as the assembly of digital communities of really unprecedented geographic dispersion plus scale, and then in building orthogonal business models. I don't know that I could have done that without those experiences, or at least not in the same way. But certainly narratively, it's all cohesive because, you know, if you take a look at my work, as you mentioned, it's not just that it's narrative. It's also that it's deeply historical, right? Taking a look at why we are arranged the way that we are. And that requires not necessarily the specific body of work that I had, certainly not, but it does require going around the block, you know, a number of different times.
But I think the reason why, one, well, I don't want to, you know, make this too personal, but like the way you think about things tends to, I think, be similar in resonance and tone to how I think about things. I seem to be a very visual thinker, and I think about things almost as though everything is vectors pushing on everything else. And so when you can trace back the lineage of how things have gotten to where they are now, they kind of make sense, and that they would not only make sense to keep doing more of the momentum or motion that is already in place, but that there will be these adjustments and changes and shifts over time. And so when I hear you talk about, again, like kind of your deep tech background or working at Amazon, or you talk about some of the anecdotes and stories about kids trying to pinch to Zoom magazines and having it not work, it only makes sense that those things will continue to unfold and that technology will meet those strange kind of idiosyncrasies or what's the word where something is out of time? Anachronistic.
Yeah.
Right. So
yeah.
right? Whereas I feel like Brian and myself and you, I think, live in sort of a sort of near future, maybe 3 to 5 years out, where things are making sense and we're just waiting for reality to catch up. And so that's why I think when I read this book, I'm like, yes, of course, this makes sense. It's so like obvious. I guess I wonder, do you find yourself being, and this is going to sound a little funny, but like frustrated by some of the conversations and questions that you have to keep answering over and over again? Or do you feel like this is actually your job as a storyteller to bring people into the current moment and to translate from the future into the present?
No, it actually doesn't frustrate me, because in a huge, I mean, if we take a step back when it comes to my book, I had a pretty intensive writing process. And that is to say that I did it pretty quickly in about 4 or 5 months, partly while doing the rest of my job. And I did something that in hindsight, I wasn't sure was smart, which was continue to have a lot of conversations. I was doing speeches. I was working with a bunch of companies in the space, as opposed to just going heads down as an author. And that process ended up being instrumental in the book, because it revealed in a way that wasn't otherwise possible what I truly didn't understand, not fully, or at least the better way to articulate certain things. And so that's why I talk about going around the block. I don't just mean working on multiple different problems. I partly mean the community of people around us. This thing about the early efforts with the iPhone, you know, so many of the stories that I've been exposed to are essential to writing this. And I actually don't know how many people who hadn't been reading Engadget or Gizmodo for 20 years, you know, could truly have the same perspective.
Yeah, I feel like, and the next one's for Brian, but like, I really am curious about what you didn't understand and what you've kind of come to recently in your insights, because I feel like the three of us have probably read or consumed many of the same sources of information. We're voracious kind of consumers of all of this content in different formats. And the way in which we synthesize and kind of create little zip files of knowledge and nuggets, I think, is the process of digesting and then bringing a certain lens that provide some elucidation or understanding. So what is it that maybe in the last 6 months you didn't understand that has become clearer to you in this process?
Well, I would certainly say that my understanding of blockchain, both good and bad, grew quite a bit. On top of that, I would say many of the deep technical problems on computing and networking were other topics that I just needed more time in the field. So for example, I talk in the book about the challenges of latency and how much of that is a conquest against the speed of light. I talk about the ways in which we think about cloud data centers as analogous to a power plant. You know, the classic example is, why am I having my Xbox compute and process and render my game rather than using the industrial factories? Right, the cloud data center. Just like I don't have a generator outside of my home, and instead I use the power grid. And the answer has a lot to do with latency, but it also has to be about GPU sharing. We're pretty good at sharing capacity on a server or CPU, but it turns out that we can't really split GPUs. They're not divisible units of power. And those are the types of things that I just knew generally, but not specifically. And when you start writing in long form, you're writing for an audience that is not expert. You start to very quickly figure out like, oh, I could go 2 clicks, but not 3 clicks. And actually the 4 clicks are the core.
You, jumping to the book, like it's like chapter 3, where the title is the definition of it. Which is kind of, you're cute about it, because you kind of spend a whole chapter giving a definition-ish. It's too much to have like a one-sentence definition of it. But one of the things that you said that is important to me is, does it have to be immersive? Like, it has to be 3D, if I'm reading you correctly. If it's not immersive, then it's just what we currently have on the internet, right? Like, the idea of what the next thing is it has to sort of be this full takeover sensory, right? Am I reading that correctly?
I would disagree with some of the modifiers. You talk about full takeover sensory. No, it doesn't need to be full takeover sensory. And I don't mean to pick too much specifically on your off-the-cuff words, but I think they're a helpful tool, right? full cutoff. Now we're basically talking about being in a sensory deprivation tank. That's the Ready Player One example. I'm literally in a shipping container strapped in a haptic suit. It doesn't need that. It's not clear that we need full senses generally, however one would define that.
But 3D is key to you.
3D is key. Otherwise, we're just talking about the internet, but more and with some other applications. I think in the same way that we would say that going to a visual form of the internet, one that supports persistent connections to servers, was essential for this generation of the internet. But certainly when you take a look at industrial applications, when we're talking about the role of XR in surgery or education in operating infrastructure, in turning the world's largest asset class, which is real estate, from something that's barely online to something that exists online, that does require not necessarily 3D as the consumer might look at it on a screen, but 3D in the sense of graphics-based computing and digital twin simulations. And so, yes, I do consider that a requirement. Doesn't mean that there won't be lots of 2D and text things that are part of it.
Is the blockchain a requirement to you? You mentioned offhand that like that's what you've been thinking about a lot over the last 6 months or whatever. Like, to what degree is crypto and blockchain vital to your vision of the metaverse?
It's not vital. But again, this is why my book's 105,000 words and why my definition chapter is 14,000 words, which is, it actually all comes down to the specific language, vital. I don't think it's vital, right? You can technically say TCP/IP was not vital to an internetworking standard. We could have other versions of the internet with other protocol stacks. HTML is not vital to the internet. It's a markup language we used. What's interesting about blockchain is there are basically two different arguments. One is on the pro side. One is that it is technically required to the extent in which if we want to actually realize the full vision of the metaverse, then we need a better way of harnessing the collective resources, spare GPUs and CPUs, network capacity. And that blockchain is a great system for that. Now, that still doesn't mean it's necessary, right? We have lots of different mechanisms for accessing decentralized technology. But they would say functionally, it's the best, most optimized, and therefore it's required to actually build the metaverse as we imagine. The second argument is not about technical realization. It's about having a metaverse we want, which is where we talk about the distribution of power, individual property rights, self-custody of your data. That's more about a thriving and healthy metaverse. Again, I still wouldn't say any is a strict requirement because we do have substitutive technologies for that.
So one of the things that I've been wondering about, I suppose, is, you know, the timing of many of these constructs in the world of technology allow us, as you say, to talk about things that have been just not part of internet lore up until now. You know, blockchain, of course, is one of those concepts, a distributed, you know, database that everyone can write to and read to, and that is essentially trustworthy. My question is about governance around the metaverse, because you've talked about getting the metaverse that we want, and we've talked about the sort of visions for the metaverse, which, of course, most people think of as being dystopic. I've sort of a two-part question. One is there a government, and I know you're Canadian, so I'm sort of teeing you off for this, but is there a government in the world that would be best suited for taking over and running the metaverse? And secondly, to what degree, if at all, are DAOs and other structures that are kind of in the Web3 world useful as a prototyping tool for thinking about how to govern in the metaverse?
So if we take a look at the metaverse in its idealized version, it's highly interoperable with common standards, not unlike the internet today. The internet today is basically like a public good, right? TCP/IP sits outside of the reach of any company. And even if the IETF, Internet Engineering Task Force, revises something, it's still kind of up to the adoption of all of the various parties. That makes it a public good. No one controls it. The challenge when we look at the metaverse is everyone adopted those standards and protocols because they preceded the commercial internet. When we talk about the advent of the metaverse, people are pioneering standards and de facto ones. And so there's a question as to whether or not interoperability can exist. I certainly believe it can. We're seeing that already. But the question is, to what extent? So some argue it will be so limited that to call it the metaverse is facile. The flip side of that is when we take a look at other economies. South Korea has established the South Korean Metaverse Alliance, now more than 500 companies, from banks to refrigerator manufacturers, automotive companies, and smartphone OEMs. And they're essentially mandating standards, not literally, but essentially. And that will disadvantage the average or the occasional company, but build a collectively more prosperous ecosystem and hopefully metaverse. That might provide an advantage versus the West. But then if you take a look at China, China is fascinating. You have basically one company in Tencent that publishes almost all virtual experiences, from Nintendo to Activision Blizzard, Square Enix, their entire portfolio. They can standardize internally, plus WeChat, plus QQ. And then the question is, will the CCP allow it? And so the CCP is definitely best positioned to de facto construct one probably more comprehensive than that we see in the West, but they may also just block it because of the threat it poses.
Well, along those lines, why won't the big platforms sort of own this? Like Chris and I spoke to Chris Dixon 6 weeks ago, and you know, part of his argument for Web3 is that we're going to disintermediate the big platforms. We're going to give a thousand flowers will bloom. People will have ownership and things like that. And I know from my own research and history of stuff like that, like even when the big platforms and the big companies know what's coming, like happened when the web came around, that doesn't mean that they will own it. But given that all of the big platforms are all looking in this direction, you're talking about standards, you're talking about people building on this stuff. How do we know that this won't just be a total capture by the Google, the Apple, the Amazon, the Meta, all that stuff?
Well, how do we know? We don't. I think where I disagree with Chris, or on the margin, is the truth of the matter is there's not a war between centralization and decentralization, not at least in the sense that one side can win. It's a spectrum. The early internet, the first 20 years of the internet, was heavily decentralized. And again, to the public good. That doesn't mean that we didn't see strong forces of centralization and positive feedback. We were all on Google. Think of the famous line, competition's a click away. It was. We didn't use it. We all ended up on the Facebook platform, and then they progressively closed even on highly decentralized underpinnings. There's many different positive feedback loops to decentralization. Brand, trust, revenue, which begets more investment and better engineers and better product, that all is centralizing. OpenSea has nearly 80% share in marketplace-based NFT transactions. They exist in a decentralized ecosystem. They take a larger cut than many of their competitors, but they have habit. And now they have authentication, validation, and blue checks. I think the question is more around, where are we? We definitely believe that we centralized too much over the last 15 and 20 years. And there is a very strong argument that building on blockchains makes it much harder and certainly less defensible to lock people in. And so that's more, in my mind, significantly kicking off that center back towards decentralization, but not moving it all together now.
And I mean, to clarify, I suppose I do tend to think of things in kind of a mode of respiration, of kind of a breathing in and a breathing out. And certainly there was decentralization in the beginning, and then we've moved towards centralization, and now there may be a move towards decentralization again, as just kind of, you know, poles that kind of move and sway over time. One question I have, and I guess I'm asking on a technical complexity perspective, given that you've written about and talked about different formats, interchange formats, different open source methodologies, different consortia that are coming together to standardize aspects of the metaverse. To what degree do you think, and I think I'm asking because it seems like the technologies of the metaverse are just much more complex relative to the HTML of the early web, that adversarial interoperability might be a mechanism by which you know, to Brian's point, we do achieve some kind of imposed decentralization on what might start out as a very centralized kind of metaverse. Is that like likely to work, or is that the formats technologies are simply just too complex to sort of move towards that that style of forced interoperability?
That's a good question. I can't speak with certainty on either side. I will tell you that I am at least hopeful about path dependency. And I think that's one of the reasons why I find Epic Games and Tim Sweeney, whom I talk about extensively in the book, so inspiring, which is, I do think you can see this one individual as very consequential into the ultimate outcome. Now, what does that mean for ultimate decentralization? How dramatic a shift can that be, right? Path dependency is just changing the path. That doesn't mean doing a 90 degree or 180. That's as yet to be seen. It partly comes down to the question of, do you think the world without Steve Jobs is entirely different or just farther behind and somewhat different? I will say that when we talk about decentralization, there's one thing that I find really encouraging, which is, you know, if you take a look at Epic, and I read about this at the end of my book, they are rewriting their user agreements and their terms of service to relinquish controls that almost every platform holds tight. For example, they've said that if they ever have a dispute with a developer who's violating their terms of service, whether it's non-payment or abuse of the license or even using it for terrorism, allegedly, they have to go to the courts to get an injunction. That's actually decentralization because they no longer have central authority over the rights of that developer, and they are giving it over to the legal system, poorly organized though it may be, that is decentralized. It's the democratic system. If he can push the poles of EULAs, that is really significant. And I think it is very specific to the individual.
I did a story a couple months ago that people have been suggesting that we don't have the bandwidth to do a full metaverse maybe for decades. And again, a metaverse like you're describing where it's 3D, where, you know, in COVID times, in the lockdown times, just streaming video kind of took our existing infrastructure to its limits. What are your thoughts on that? Like, do we have the infrastructure to do what we're dreaming of? Is this something that maybe the infrastructure is going to keep us from doing for maybe more time than Mark Zuckerberg would like?
Yeah, I think part of the question here is really about what degree of experience for whom and when. Overall, your points are exactly right, but it's very unevenly distributed. So let me give an example. Just from a latency perspective, which is pretty essential here, we believe that 3/4 of Americans can reliably access a high-fidelity, real-time rendered world. That's not great, right? And it's reliable. It doesn't mean high bandwidth. It doesn't mean all the time. But 1 in 4 can't. When you take a look at the Middle East, it's only 1 in 4 that can. When you take a look at India, it's 1 in 10 can. Solving that is a big portion of what we need to do, and it's separate from whether or not the price of an Oculus and other devices comes down over time. But as we solve many of those things, we will solve many of the aforementioned bandwidth problems. But overall, we do think we're very short of what's required. My favorite example is this quote from John Carmack, who's the former founder of id. He was the CTO of Oculus, and he is called building the metaverse a moral imperative. He said that if you asked him in 2000, if we had 100x the computing power we had today, would we be able to build the metaverse? And he said, I would have said, yeah. Well, it's been 22 years. We have 6 or 7 billion devices with over 120x that power. And he still admits that there are enormous concessions required. Intel believes that we need a 1,000-factor increase. And so we generally find that we need a lot more than we ever prepare for. But that doesn't mean that we won't be able to build certain elements of the experience for some people very soon. We're seeing that already.
on a similar sort of line, you know, I'm 44, I'm old enough. My entire adult life, I've been told that VR is the next big thing. I know VR is just one component of this, or AR or whatever. But, you know, I was also, I'm old enough to remember when the video on the web was going to happen, and it never happened until YouTube came, and then it happened. And the mobile web, it was going to happen, and then the iPhone came, and it happened. Is there some sort of a trigger technologically, some sort of innovation that you can see that we're still waiting for the metaverse to mainstream?
Well, so it depends. I mean, look, we've got 3/4 of American, Canadian, British, Australian kids are using Roblox each day. On a regular basis. That's pretty meaningful. And if you draw that trend out, it doesn't matter how fully realized it is or not. It doesn't matter if they think of the term metaverse. That's pretty consequential. But I think the most important way to think about it, in my perspective, is really to take in mind that we see these bursts, these critical mass points. For example, we know that 3G was not for any physical reason. There's no law of the earth, but 3G was a breaking point for the mobile ecosystem, or like building point. When you take a look at what's happened with gaming, it was really around 2015 that we had the advent of widely deployed GPUs and CPUs and SoCs that enabled large 3D rendered social experiences with dozens or 100 plus people. And when that happened, we had this massive burst in the gaming industry. Roblox took off. Fortnite became the biggest game in the world. And so we don't know exactly what the next unlock is, but we didn't know exactly that 2015 was going to transform gaming. But certainly there are those who believe that the AR and VR of our imagination does require extraordinary advances in battery, for which we have no foreseeable path, or the mainstream at scale demonstration of quantum computing.
All right, Matt, I've got one more for you. And this is going to be a little bit of a off the wall question. I've never heard you talk about this before or write about it. So we'll see where this goes and we'll see if you have an answer. But, you know, famously, I would say a lot of Silicon Valley and Silicon Valley culture was informed through the use of psychedelics. And the psychedelic experience seems to be somewhat adjacent to the sort of vision of the metaverse that, you know, technologists and designers, you know, dream of. Increasingly in media, whether you're watching, you know, movies or films, the type of content, visuals that you're seeing are clearly psychedelically inspired, if not enriched, you know. And even in most of Apple's keynotes, there's some allusion to the crack marketing team that goes off and, you know, has some sort of crazy trip to come up with the next name for some geographic region in California. My question to you is really about timing and about generational change. I think both to Brian's point about where we are generationally in terms of also how we grew up on the internet, you know, seeing these see changes happen as a result of a younger generation coming up in a 3D environment and making an assumption that should be the way that you connect and compute with other people, seems like the baseline is being reset. So I wonder, to what degree do you think that psychedelics and the sort of psychedelic revival that is currently going on has had an influence on the receptivity of these concepts and of the desire to almost create this space in which those types of experiences might be more generalizable or more generally shared to other people without necessarily having to rely on psychedelic substances to achieve these extraworldly moments?
So that's a really good question. And I'm loath to respond because I don't think I can do the detail that you provided any justice. The answer is no. I mean, like, I don't know. To what degree was it or was it not instrumental is not something that I can speak to in great detail. I will tell you one of my favorite stories. This is somewhat aside, which is when I grew up, the Fantasia, which was one of my favorite movies, was famous, right? It was a classic. That's one of the things that your parents gave you. or when you were growing up. I think what's fascinating about that is it's actually Walt Disney's third film. That's crazy. They made Snow White, then it was Song of the South, which does not hold up well. But then they made Fantasia. And Fantasia was not successful. And then they re-released it, and it still didn't work. And then they re-released it, and it still didn't work. And then in the 60s, they released it again. And they started, you can find the posters online, they redid the posters and they're psychedelic, right? The ad company really knew what they were doing. And it became this hit in the boomer generation. And it is that, not the 30s, that made it the cultural touchstone that it is today. And so without weighing into what should or shouldn't be, I'm Canadian enough to have a pretty permissive approach to what should and shouldn't be allowed. There's a pretty good example of what people want and what can be creatively liberating and how so much of that is about cultural shift as opposed to necessarily legal shift.
Yeah. And it just seems to me that, for the generation that's growing up in a world in which those types of experiences are more normalized, talking about the metaverse is actually not that strange. Whereas when I've heard you give interviews, the level of skepticism and doubt and resistance that I hear seems to come from sort of a perspective that, has an aversion to that level of loss of control or, to being in this contrived space or environment. And yet what you can imagine could occur as a creative endeavor in those spaces, I think is just really fascinating. It just seems like there might be a kernel of something there. But anyways, so Matthew Ball, thank you so much for joining us today. The book is called The Metaverse and How It Will Revolutionize Everything. It's funny because I'm sort of going back and rereading Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind, which seems somewhat related. Anyways, thanks again for joining us. This is super, super amazing.
Yeah, my pleasure, guys.
Thank you, Matt. Cheers.
Hey, everybody. Brian here. This next segment starts out a little low on volume, but if you stick with it for about 10 minutes, it definitely gets better, close to normal. With everybody fighting for attention, how can your business stand out and connect with customers? Easy. Get Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketing platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. Constant Contact makes it easy to promote your business with powerful tools like email and SMS marketing, social media posting, and even events management. With Constant Contact, you'll reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and communicate more effectively to sell more, raise more, and fast-track growth. Don't know much about marketing? No sweat. Constant Contact's writing assistance tools and automation features help you say the right thing at the right time, every time. Plus, you can send with confidence knowing your emails are actually reaching your customers thanks to Constant Contact's best-in-class 97% deliverability rate. I use this, and you should too. Tackle any challenge with Constant Contact's expert live customer support. Plus, everything's backed by their 30-day money-back guarantee, so get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com. We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there is no compromise. So don't go back to that one doctor who uses your appointment to catch up on the latest headlines, their family group chat, their crossword puzzles, just because they're available right now or they take your slightly sketchy insurance. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, listen to you, and prioritize your health. And you can search by location, availability, and insurance, so literally no compromises here, because with ZocDoc, you've got more options than you know. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. No more waiting awkwardly on hold with a receptionist. And these docs all have verified reviews from actual real patients. We're talking about booking appointments with tens of thousands of top-rated patient-reviewed credible doctors and specialists. I have personally used ZocDoc to find a podiatrist when I needed one for the first time ever in my life. Go to ZocDoc.com/techmeme and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/techmeme. ZocDoc.com/techmeme.
So, Chris, go ahead and double-check and confirm for me that you're recording, and then let's just go.
I'm good. Okay, Jason, you're good?
I am.
Okay, I'll kick us off. Welcome, everybody, to the Tech Meme Ride Home Experience for Friday, July 29th. We're actually recording, I think this is the earliest show we've ever recorded, 9 a.m. PST, noon EST. So you're not going to get, well, actually, maybe you will get a sexier voice from me. I'm not sure. I'm just barely having my coffee, so I'm getting started. But
does this mean I can't take a gummy halfway through this?
Well, it's probably a good thing that you haven't taken your gummy yet. But it is Friday, so, you know, you do you. But yeah, so today we've actually got a very, a guest that's actually been a friend of the Tech Meme Pod for a long time. In fact, I just listened to your interview from 2019, Jason, with Brian. And it's pretty fascinating to just think about all the changes that have occurred since then. And you guys actually were live in person the last time you, at least during that show. So it's great to have you back on, but, Brian, you want to introduce Jason?
Yeah. So, Jason Del Rey is my go-to for covering Amazon. And it's funny, you know what, I was going to do broader tech earnings first, but let's go ahead and start with Amazon, because Jason, when we recorded that episode, I think it was at the Vox Studios or something, I remember one of my questions to you was that, does Amazon feel different? There was like a vibe shift. Like I felt like at the time they were behaving differently. They were more aggressive or whatever. I'm kind of wondering, because, I mean, let's just go into the post-Jeff Bezos era.
Yeah.
Do you feel like those last few years of Bezos being the CEO at Amazon, things were, in retrospect, pretty much already starting to be in flux?
Yeah, I mean, I can take that in a few ways. I think the last few years have been influx is a generous way to say it. I mean, I just think they obviously they've had scrutiny come at them in so many different ways from Congress, regulators, and I'm just talking U.S. for now. Congress, regulators, labor, internal worker organizing, both on the corporate side in some ways, but also most notably in the warehouse network. And, you know, to me, it all goes back to, did Bezos take his eye off the ball as he was out being the world's richest man and becoming less involved? But also, I think just in a lot of ways, like the world changed, and like Amazon leadership didn't change. They thought, you know, the same type of public relations strategies, the same type of treatment of partners, all the way down to the same way you manage your workforce, could still work. And I think over the last few years, in many ways, they've been shown to have been wrong. Now, still an open question where any of this goes, from regulation to the labor organizing to the impact on just sort of the company's core business. But I think 2018, 2019 started to feel like a shift in all these different ways, and we're seeing some of the fallout now.
Well, I mean, that's maybe the nature of regime changes like this, right? You know, maybe Jeff had a bit of senioritis as we're sort of armchair, analyzing him. All of a sudden he becomes buff. All of a sudden, you know, there's things in his personal life that are changing. But it's also the nature of things that maybe when someone is thinking of leaving, they take their eye off the ball. But at the same time, until they leave, some of those new ideas and those new ways of working can't come to the fore because people aren't in position yet. There's the whole question of the succession, and not just at the top, but all, you know, how a reorg would go when there's somebody new at the top. So in a way, maybe those last 3 or 4 years of the Bezos tenure, things were in flux, but also kind of frozen, as you're describing, at the same time.
Yeah, I think maybe so. I think, you know, I should also just note, like, the pandemic's arrival in, I guess, late 2019 and then really 2020 in the U.S. totally overwhelmed, you know, people's personal lives, but also just corporations large and small. And so Bezos did get more involved, and you know, okayed the giant warehouse build-out hiring sprees that he and others felt the company needed to you know, try to keep up with demand. And let me be clear here. Like, Amazon, for tons and tons of people, and, you know, was a lifeline. And, you know, not only people who chose to stay home, but people who, you know, still have to stay home because of, you know, what the virus could mean to them, or definitely did at the time because of, you know, health conditions or whatnot. And so, you know, Amazon keeping up with demand, like, there was a lot of good around that. On the financial side, obviously, Jassy comes in, and we can, I don't know how deep we want to go into this, but Jassy comes in last July, realizes quickly, I think with some others, that the company was overextending itself with warehouses and hiring, and starts to pull back. And then in the last couple of quarters, we finally see that manifest itself in the company's financials.
Is that maybe the biggest sort of thing that Bezos got head faked by COVID? Like, basically half of the tech industry did. But then
I think the retail world did in some ways too, right? I mean, we're seeing what's going on with inventory overstock. I follow Walmart relatively closely too. I'm writing next year. I'll have a book out about the Walmart Amazon rivalry and Walmart's attempts to reinvent itself under its current CEO. And so I think a lot of the retail industry did in different ways. But I'll let you finish the question.
Well, I mean, I guess the question is, you know, and I guess this would lead into my questions about Andy Jassy. Is your sense that I think we can posit that he obviously might have a different personality than Bezos did, but is what he's been doing this year so far been what it's been characterized as, which is kind of undoing some of the excesses or undoing some of the mistakes or just the legacy stuff that it's like the dam is breaking because now all the new ideas can't happen? Is there a sense inside Amazon that we are undoing some mistakes, is I guess what I'm asking.
I think for sure. And whether they're messaged internally as cost cutting or undoing mistakes, or, you know, as Amazon I think rightfully says publicly a lot, you know, we experiment in a lot of ways, and we get things right, we get things wrong, and we're not afraid to cut bait and move on. That's definitely been a lot of what's happening, and how Jassy has spent, you know, I think based on some other reporting and folks I've talked to, maybe as much as a third of his time was trying to figure out the retail warehousing capacity and hiring issues. And so that has happened for sure. But we also got a hint that the company is going to continue to step up investments in AWS, not surprising for a couple of reasons. One, Jassy ran AWS for a long time, obviously. Two, profit, one of the main profit engines of the company, and still a lot of room for growth there. And so they'll be shifting some capital spending there from the retail business, it seems. So spending time there. And then on the retail side, I think Jassy is still undecided about the physical store initiatives. I mean, obviously, they closed down the bookstores. You know, they brought in a new head of the store unit from the UK, and under his new leadership, and also with Jassy okaying it, they closed down the bookstores. But there's one area I think Jassy is, you know, likely still a fan, which is, you know, the walk out of the store without paying, Amazon Go type technology. Now, how that manifests itself long term, is it Amazon's own stores, or perhaps more likely, is Amazon just sell that technology more broadly as they've started to do? I think that's one sort of area of invention outside of AWS where I think there's a long-term commitment there.
We've also heard that, you know, maybe they're cutting back their ambitions in terms of drone delivery and stuff, which if you tie that with, like, the retail experiments, you know, the physical retail experiments and things like that, Like, that's where I think people are getting the sense that that era, that Bezos era of, oh, we'll deliver things by drones. Oh, we'll dream up new gadgets and new sort of, you know, the joke was 2 or 3 years ago when Amazon did a hardware event, it was the worst thing to cover because they would announce 75 things, yeah, you know. Yeah, right. So are we getting the sense that that is part of the sort of vibe shift, that sort of experimentation is maybe going to be curtailed?
I don't know yet. That's for sure something I'm watching closely. I will say, as I've talked to former Amazon leaders over the last couple of years during the pandemic and reflected on where Amazon is as a company, something that came up a lot was like, when was the last big Amazon invention? And most people honestly would point to Alexa and the Echo, which I'm forgetting now whether that was 13 or 14.
Right.
But that period. And these are, and let me be clear, these are people who are overall fans of the company, worked there a long time, but just felt like, you know, as the company grew, they made, you know, sort of amazing incremental advancements in sort of the speed of Prime, building out their own delivery network. And yes, yeah, some people would say, you know, the just walked out technology of the retail stores, you know, could be a huge business in the future, but still unproven in how expensive it would be was a big question mark. And, I just thought, you know, that was really telling about the back half of the Bezos, era, was that you have people who are fans of the company just wondering, like, where was the invention? Like, you know, we refer to ourselves in some ways as an innovation company, and where's that hit? And, you know, I'll let you know, other people judge whether that's fair or not, but hearing it over and over again, and or things like, you know, it is day two at Amazon. You know, famously, that Bezos and Amazonians talk about, you know, it's always day one, you know, where it's always time to, you know, build. Hearing fans of the company who've worked inside saying it feels like day two, I think that's, you know, somewhat worrisome for the company.
I guess, like, one of the things to consider here is to place Amazon kind of in the broader context of the rest of the tech world, and to sure. look at a kind of, I don't know if maturing is the right word, but certainly there's been a series of leadership changes that are occurring at, you know, other companies. You know, specifically, obviously, Facebook and Meta is one of the most recent ones. That's probably in sort of it's not really a parallel class, but in terms of the way that we think about it and the way in which it is ubiquitous and the way in which it touches so many people in somewhat controversial ways. I suppose, like, one of the questions that I have is about assumptions that the pandemic drove about the likely state of how things were going to be going forward. Because obviously the big question about the pandemic, and even, you know, as we're still in it in many respects, is when it would end and whether or not we were actually bringing the future forward by 5 or 10 years, such mm-hmm. that it would make sense to push super hard in this expansion. Because, you know, as both a product person and as a technologist and someone who's been in the field building products, it's always been one of those, and we actually, Brian and I talked about this on a recent show, it's one of those things where rolling out products takes a long time because you kind of have to bring people along for those transitions, right? So whether it's voice computing and Alexa, you kind of have to get people into the mindset of having an always on speaker in the house. And that while there are privacy implications for that, that the convenience that you get out of it is actually worth it from a trade-off perspective, and that'll become clear to you over time. But we're also sort of in a moment where as product designers, it's oftentimes, you know, how do you explain this to your mom, or how do you get people who are non technophiles to understand this? And I feel like that's actually another shift that has occurred, where there was an assumption that bringing the future forward by 5 or 10 years meant that more and more people would just, you know, have computers, have some technical sophistication. And maybe instead of 5 or 10 years, we've actually brought the future forward by like 2 or 3. So there's a recalibration and a resetting, and that's I guess I'm trying to unpack what you said about the executives were wrong about certain things, to understand, one, what you see how they were wrong, and then two, whether or not, like, if they had not made those big leaps to assume that the future was going to get here that much faster, that they actually could have been left behind had the future actually arrived as fast as maybe some of us optimistically thought.
Absolutely. Like I probably don't have to be clear on this, but I have not run a sizable business. I've definitely not run any bit of Amazon side or divisions that these VPs or GMs or senior VPs or CEOs are running. So, and I can see the headlines and the customer complaints if, you know, Amazon had not hired as much as they did and or built out as many delivery stations and they, you know, sort of couldn't keep up with demand. Even, you know, they struggled at times for sure, just like a lot of people did. So 100%. I mean, I don't know if a no-win situation, if it's, I go as far as a no-win situation, but, you know, they made a bet that thought that some of the top leaders thought was in the best interest of customers. They talk about customer obsession, ad nauseum. I think in this way that did actually lead that decision. And it seems like they were off. So I don't, my job's not to judge them, but I don't judge.
Well, from an analysis perspective, decision. Right? Like, yeah, you can sort of say, well, you know, based on what they knew or based on what we thought we knew about, you know, a global pandemic, it made sense to push so heavily in this direction. One, because, you know, as you said, there was customer demand. There was suddenly we were all at home and Amazon was like, you know, just as AWS is perfectly set up for like the holiday shopping season, suddenly, you know, Amazon and its logistics prowess was sort of perfectly set up for taking advantage of the changes that, you know, were brought on by the pandemic. And so now, I guess my question is kind of like, were they wrong or is it now a period of recalibration and cutting back on many of the things that, you know, were sort of speculative bets, knowing that many of the things that were leading to those ideas being interesting, you know, maybe before are now no longer as relevant or interesting because the behavior of their customers and their expectations of many more people have evolved or changed. I guess my question is, do you see that now and going forward, those customer expectations are actually quite different than they were 2 or 3 years ago? Or are customer expectations and behaviors resetting to how they were previously 2 or 3 years ago?
Let me answer it this way. Okay. I think the bet on rapid expansion did not pay off. And now they are recalibrating. And I think that is what good businesses do when they have a bet that doesn't pay off. And now the question is, I mean, frankly, just to get in the weeds on the wood, you know, on the, on the logistics business a little, can they get Prime back to a place that they had promised customers it would be?
It is no longer a 2-day delivery service.
I mean, and beyond that, like, the big announcement, and I get into this in my book a little bit, the back and forth between Amazon and Walmart on this, but their big announcement back in, I think, the spring of, I want to say 19, that Prime was now a 1-day, they'll say shipping service, but most people expect it, when they see shipping, they expect, I order it today, I'll get it tomorrow. So 1-day delivery service, next day. I think they've made progress this year, but they're 100% not there. And in that time frame, they raised the price of the service. And I just think that is one thing I will knock them on as not customer obsessed. The fact that, you know, Prime has not been what they said it would be. And they will say all the other perks, but they sold it to many people as a 1- and 2-day delivery service. And for a lot of people in a lot of times over the last few years, it has not been that. Some of it's understandable. But I think they could do better in that regard. And I think, frankly, I think competitors, you know, had an opportunity to sort of go hard at them on that. And I have not seen that happen. Maybe because competitors couldn't do any better.
Put a pin in making Prime more attractive to people again, because I want to come back to that with the healthcare question. But before we get on to that and the recent acquisition, I feel like Andy Jassy, I don't follow as close as you do, he still feels opaque to me. Like when we were talking about, you know, the experimentation that Bezos loved, you know, the guy has a rocket company, for God's sakes, wants to go to space. So it was obvious that he loved to try weird off the wall things. Is Is your sense of Jassy, you know, maybe the best way to do it is everyone said that, you know, Tim Cook to Steve Jobs was not a product guy. He's more of the nuts and bolts sort of logistics guy, more, you know, keeping the trains running on time guy. And that's kind of proven out to be true. If you had to contrast the personality or the vision that Andy Jassy has to Bezos's, what do you think you would say?
So I think for sure people describe Jassy as more of an operator, and that means, you know, to mean he has really, like, he dives into the weeds to the point that it has annoyed some senior executives who were used to more free reign under Jeff and just more trust. I think also while he started, Jassy started sort of in the retail business way back in, late 90s, early 2000s. He was, you know, launching and running AWS. And so I find often journalists, or I'll just speak for myself, I often try to look for like deeper meaning or like hidden signs when there's a executive transition, and not just look at about what to expect, and not just look at like the facts. And the facts are like Jassy ran, loved running AWS, ran that thing for so long. And like, I think Amazon under him is going to invest even more heavily into that business than maybe would have under Bezos. And I think Amazon's always going to be a retail and marketplace company, but that's not where his main interests are. And I think coming in, him seeing, you know, flaws in that, he had to dive in and understand what was going wrong in that business. But I think, you know, if we're looking just like investment wise, I think his vision is AWS expanding in all sorts of different ways and getting this retail business right. And that part of that means pulling back on some of the Bezos-led expansion, like the physical stuff. On a personal level, I've had limited interactions with Andy, met Bezos a handful of times. People will say, like, Jassy, they describe him as like more human than Bezos. I think his EQ is higher. I think I think they need him to get out there more talking to critics. I mean, Walmart back in the 2000s did sort of a listening tour of all their critics. You know, a lot of it was self-serving, but, you know, their leader got out, their CEO got out there. And Amazon hasn't done a lot of that. So we've seen reports that Jassy's been in D.C. a few times already. What the company's been doing in D.C. the last few years, I think has, we'll see if it works or not, but it was a very combative relationship, and it appears like he's trying to smooth some things over. And you know,
and you definitely feel like that sort of charm initiative to regulators, that's definitely coming from Jassy.
Oh well, I mean,
and by charm initiative, yeah. what I'm saying is, as opposed to being very combative, and you know, Bezos only ever testified before Congress like I think once in his entire tenure. But like, you hear these rumors now that Amazon is floating possible remedies. Okay, maybe we'll do A and B in order to placate you, so that maybe you don't come down. Like, that was never on the table, in my understanding, in the Bezos.
So I reported on one of those, which was, you know, the private, like the consideration that if there were some really harsh remedies on the table, that internally there was some alignment that they would, while they don't think they should have to, they'd give up the private label business, because if it becomes not worth it, then it's just not worth it to them. That was dating back to like to last year, and I guess Jassy came in July. I don't know that I don't believe he led that conversation. You know, I think there's a recognition. Jassy's a bright guy, more EQ than Jeff, and I think there's a recognition that you can only be combative for so long. And so I don't know what exactly he has said in these DC meetings. I'm sure he has pushed back hard against the self-preferencing bill that still hasn't gotten a vote and maybe will never. But I think just the fact that he's been willing and to be there, where his predecessor was not, even though he lived there in many ways and had a mansion there, I think just says something about a strategy difference and just sort of a personal difference in approaches.
Real quick, before I ask you about One Medical, you said something a few minutes ago that I kind of did a whiplash on, which was, do we know that AWS and Amazon Retail will always be one company? Like, what would you put the odds on them splitting out AWS and retail, say, by the end of this decade?
Ooh. I suddenly turned into Scott Galloway.
Does that mean you're for it, or that means you want it?
No. I just that you're asking me to predict it. And I'll take a shot, and there's literally no downside to me getting it wrong. So what year? I don't even know what year we're in. We're in 2022, so the end of this decade. Whether by choice or by outside force, I'd say they're retail and AWS are separate companies by the end of this decade.
Well, except for the fact that I can see if they go into healthcare that having AWS still in house might be useful. So, okay, yeah. The One Medical acquisition, and I'm going to tie it back into the Amazon Prime thing, which is, Prime is a lot less valuable to me. You're raising the prices. I don't care about your Lord of the Rings show. But hey, if all of a sudden there is a suite of clinics around the country that if I have a sore throat as part of my Amazon Prime membership, it'll cost me $10 to go in and get a quick checkout. And oh, by the way, Amazon will ship me the medicine that I need and things like that. That would make Prime an interesting thing. What's your take on the direction that you think Amazon wants to go in with healthcare?
Yeah, I think Jassy is a big believer that they can be a huge innovator here. I think in some ways the Amazon Care initiative, which is sort of the virtual care and in-home care that they piloted and rolled out with employees, sort of came out of someone who I believe was reporting up into his org. So he's a big believer. I think they're trying to put all the pieces together, and I think they have a real shot to be super disruptive from everything from pharmacy to care. Now they have the physical clinics with a sizable existing customers base there. I just think that the execution of piecing that all together is really hard. And I think there are a lot of pundits who just assume Amazon will nail it. And I'm just interested to see how it goes. I have a chapter in my book that's coming out about both Amazon and Walmart's healthcare initiatives. And Walmart's building, their own sort of everything clinics inside some stores. I think they have a couple dozen. And both these companies feel like with their customer base and their customer touch and that they can do better in terms of the experience, the transparency and pricing and all that. And I think Amazon with the One Medical acquisition is sort of several steps ahead. And I do think there's a world where Prime, people are getting, starting maybe to question Prime a little bit with delivery not being what it was. Yeah, the content's great, the music's fine, but Amazon feeling pressure to add to it. And for sure, this is an area where there is a ton of potential. I just think the execution's hard and will take several years. And so we'll first see if this acquisition is allowed to happen. I expect it to happen, but you never know based on what we just saw the FTC try to do with Facebook's
acquisition that, and that news that just broke this week.
When you go through airport security, there's one line where the TSA agent checks your ID and another line where a machine scans your bag. The same thing happens in enterprise security, but instead of passengers and luggage, it's end users and their devices. These days, most companies are pretty good at the first part of the equation where they check user identity, but user devices can roll right through authentication without getting inspected at all. In fact, 47% of companies allow unmanaged, untrusted devices to access their data. That means an employee can log in from a laptop that has its firewall turned off and hasn't been updated in 6 months, or worse, that laptop might belong to a bad actor using employee credentials. Collide finally solves the device trust problem. Collide ensures that no device can log into your Okta-protected apps unless it passes your security checks. Plus, you can use Collide on devices without MDM, like your Linux fleet, contractor devices, and every BYOD phone and laptop in your company. Visit collide.com/ride to watch a demo and see how it all works. That's KOLIDE.com/ride, collide.com/ride. Let's be real for a minute. Most guys would wear a t-shirt every day of their lives if they could. The problem is that most t-shirts are not acceptable to wear at work or out on a hot date night. But today's sponsor, Cuts, has finally changed that. Cuts t-shirts are such high quality, wrinkle-free, and so buttery soft that you can look like you're dressing up even when you're dressing down. Yeah, you heard that. Wrinkle-free. You never have to substitute comfort for fashion ever again. If you see me in a t-shirt, it's likely one from Cuts. I'm also a huge fan of their AO five-pocket pants, the right sort of step-up from jeans without going all the way into dress pants, like literally my ideal Venn diagram of professional-looking but comfortable feeling. When you touch something from Cuts, you can immediately feel the quality. Their proprietary fabric blends are ridiculously soft and breathable, they don't wrinkle, and they look way more expensive than they actually are. For a limited time, our listeners get 20% off your entire order when you use code RIDE at checkout. That's 20% off your order at cutsclothing.com with promo code RIDE. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Experience the perfect blend of style and comfort with Cuts Clothing. cutsclothing.com, promo code RIDE for 20% off.
But it seems like, I guess, I wonder if you see that there are any parallels, lessons to be learned, or insights, you know, to be gleaned from what happened with Whole Foods. I mean, essentially, it feels like Amazon, you know, comes along and grabs some of these marquee brands that are, you know, quite well known, you know, are good at what they do, and they don't have a lot of kind of Amazonification, if you will, like internally of how they run. And I was thinking sort of more actually of MGM in that case, but like, you know, Whole Foods obviously had some tech, but wasn't, you know, very online. You know, they're you couldn't really buy from their stores through the internet. And of course, now you can shop, you know, Whole Foods from the Amazon website. In a similar way, I've been a customer of One Medical for quite some time, and they actually are quite very online. And the quality of care and service is actually very good relative to any other, you know, care provider that I've had previously. One of, I guess, my question and thought is, you know, Amazon seems to find in some ways these best of breed companies that may be a little bit more expensive because they're doing what they do, you know, quite well, but without the efficiencies that Amazon tends to bring through just, you know, their rigor and through their, what was Bezos' original job? He was a hedge fund manager or something?
An analyst for a hedge fund.
Yeah. So anyways, it kind of all comes down to like quant, whereas like these folks tend to, you know, do a pretty good job on qual. So my question is, you know, I've sort of like done a little like digging and did notice that this Amazon Clinic brand might be present. I don't know if One Medical replaces Clinic, if it operates alongside Clinic, if these two things are internally competitive, and whether or not Amazon will more or less leave One Medical as is in place, just like they did with Whole Foods, but over time start to replace or improve the efficiencies of those services. And then my second question is about personnel and human resources. Obviously, in the case of logistics, Amazon is struggling to find a sufficient number of workers for the warehouses and for drivers and et cetera. I would imagine that there's a similar crunch either occurring or will occur in the healthcare space. And so if Amazon wants to roll out One Medical to all of its customers in, you know, all the different places that exist, what likely do you see happening on the labor front with regards to staffing One Medical? So the first is about technology and changing One Medical, and then the other is about personnel.
Yep. And I just,
you mentioned Whole Foods, so I just have to ask one question, because I've been underwhelmed by Amazon's ownership of Whole Foods.
100%.
And so...
Wait. I want to start... can you guys unpack that? Because, what were your expectations? What did you think it would become? I liked Whole Foods as it was. I mean, it was expensive, but produce was good, et cetera. What did you expect versus what is?
I have returned things to Whole Foods, but I expected
that you bought at Amazon? Because I've done that. Right. So it's a distribution center.
I was expecting more of that, of using their footprint to be in the real world more for the other stuff that Amazon does. Mm-hmm. And yes, when I ordered groceries from Amazon that comes from the Whole Foods down in Gowanus, so that's fine. If all they wanted was for them to just have an easy entree into making groceries a part of our lives, our Amazon life, fine. I just thought that there was more technology stuff, more integration into everything else Amazon does, and I haven't seen any of that really.
Yeah, and I think maybe we're starting to see some of it. I believe just they have their the Just Walk Out technology, or some of their new technologies just starting to roll out in some Whole Foods stores. And how many years out are we?
Five years.
I think it was, 2017.
Okay. Wow. It's crazy.
So maybe it's just slower. Maybe it's just slower than I thought. And actually my family, we do minimal pop. I live in New Jersey. We do minimal pop-ins at Whole Foods. So I'm not the best personal case. We're not a regular. I just thought what stood out to me was Amazon pulling back the delivery from Whole Foods. Again, we didn't use it often, but the free, quote unquote, free delivery from Whole Foods for Prime members last year was just a super un-Amazonian, if that's a word, decision. And I just think that spoke to difficulties and them not getting out of it what they thought they were going to. But let me go back to One Medical for a second. I think I'll start with the staffing side and the labor issues you were talking about. I think even at One Medical size, from folks I've talked to and some limited research I've done as I've started to look into the company, I think there's already quite a bit of turnover among their staff. Take online reviews for what they are, but I've seen a bunch about, just turnover and that affecting the experience. I'm not a customer or patient. I don't know what the right word is anymore. So maybe you've had a different experience than you do repeatedly.
There's been mobility. There's been turnover. And by mobility, I mean sort of people moving from, I think, one office to another. The way in which the clinics are set up, I think what's really interesting is it almost is run a little bit more like a customer service, for your health kind of operation, mm-hmm. where you start in an app, you send a message, that message gets triaged. And then based on that triage, it'll determine what type of service, you might need or what the nearest or local clinic is. Now, I've also moved a lot in the last, 10, 15 years. So my One Medical office has always kind of been moving around with me. So in that sense, I also haven't really developed a long-term relationship with any particular doctor. And again, this is very just my personal experience. But as a result, I haven't noticed any impact on the care I've received necessarily. And in terms of, my records being kind of up to date and having access to those things and having generally people on the other end that felt competent, when I've periodically dipped into, Aetna or other types of healthcare providers, it felt like I was dealing with this, the government, this monolithic sort of organization that really just does everything inside of itself and has no sense for the customer. Whereas One Medical, I at least felt like I was treated like, a person. So I don't mean to overgeneralize on my personal experience, but I believe that the turnover that you're mentioning is probably true. I don't know if it's higher or lower than the industry average. And I don't know if it's a benefit of working for One Medical that they actually give you that level of flexibility.
All fair and good point. So I would imagine if this deal is approved that they leave it alone for a period of time, there's going to be a lot of learning that needs to happen. I think, even as Amazon's done a bunch of hiring in healthcare, again, for reporting for my book, I've talked to folks specifically who've worked on the Amazon Care
business, which is the virtual and in-home right. sort of concierge service, and talked to some nurses who said, you know, it is a technology-focused organization, which is sometimes very frustrating for folks who come from the medical field and mm-hmm. feeling like leadership still needs to figure out where healthcare is different from other industries as it pertains to technology, you know, type of technology that's yeah. necessary. And and then also I've talked to folks who, you know, were sort of in tech health who go into Amazon and just, you know, and feel like there's really a focus, and maybe you need some of this on everything that's wrong with healthcare inside the Amazon health organization, rather than, you know, acknowledging the parts of the systems that work and maybe not trying to reinvent everything from scratch. So there's been a learning experience, I think, inside that org. And, you know, so I think they'll leave it alone for a while. I think absolutely you don't do this deal unless you see a path to integration into a bundle, whether that's Prime Health or whatever they want to call it. And
primary
again,
care.
Maybe, mm-hmm. yeah. Oh yeah. Primary care for sure. And, you know, if some of these technology integrations at Whole Foods have taken 5 years to happen, and that's not healthcare and sort of a rather straightforward retail business, you know, maybe we have to set our expectations on, you know, how long this healthcare path will take. And I think Jassy is a leader who is in it for the long term, and so maybe if I come back and talk to you guys in 3 years, we won't have seen, you know, a huge revolution in healthcare from Amazon, but maybe 7 years. And, oh God, if I'm still covering this company in 7 years, that'll be about 16 years of coverage by then.
Well, listen, anyway. it can't be 3 years, because theoretically your book is going to come out before then. Let me ask you one more and then let's yeah. wrap on this. Healthcare as an industry is also heavily unionized. And you had a piece just this morning, leaked internal memo reveals Amazon's anti-union strategies. So among other things that maybe are evolving, do we see Amazon's labor strategy evolving, or are they going to double down in fighting against unionization?
I mean, one of Bezos's last things was about how it's going to be the world's best place to work, right? So how does that jive with all these things that you're seeing now?
Yeah, Earth's best employer, right. and safest place to work. I think. Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think of how to wrap this in a couple of minutes, because I have a lot of thoughts on this topic. I think Amazon leadership, including Jassy, has thought for a long time that we do a lot of things better than our peers as it relates to employment. And we don't, not only do we not get credit for that, but we get knocked for our quote unquote sort of innovations around productivity and the like. And, you know, I was talking to a radio station today about the leaked memo and, long-term how Amazon deals with unions. I don't see any signs that they're going to just say, you know what, we're going to stop the captive audience meetings when you know, and telling workers why unions are going to be terrible for them. And we're just going to say, if you want to organize this warehouse, we're not going to stand in your way. Come in and do it, organizers. Like, I've seen zero sign of that. That said, this is not going to stop anytime soon. You know, you have the homegrown Amazon labor union in Staten Island, still have Bessemer, Alabama vote up in the air. The Teamsters all over just trying to create havoc. I just wonder at what point it becomes a resource staffing and just energy distraction enough that
Amazon comes to agreement with someone. I think it's I still think it's far-fetched. And, you know, former executives say, you know, unionization, they see, and this memo says, you know, basically as, you know, an existential threat to how they do business. But things change. I don't know. Things change. And so I'm not expecting it, but there's been so much upheaval at Amazon in the last few years that nothing would surprise me.
Well, as I said, it's not going to be 3 years before you come on again, because you have to come on to tell us about this book. Do you have a title for the book yet?
We have a working title. That's the working title is Winner Sells All. But we will, by next year, I will know for sure whether that is the title we go out in.
It is sort of the eternal dance, I guess, between Amazon and Walmart.
It is, and it's, you know, I look at some key inflection points and topics in their rivalry, from healthcare to grocery, but the book leans a little more heavily into the Walmart side, going inside sort of the Doug McMillon's been the CEO of Walmart for about eight years now, going inside his tenure, the Jet.com acquisition, their move into healthcare, and trying to sort of lay out the stakes of these, both for these companies, but also for us all, that so much of retail in the U.S. goes through both of them.
Okay. Thank you, Jason, for coming on and talking about that. I just did a search on Amazon, and I did not see a placeholder for the book. So, we're not that close yet.
We're early.
It's day zero. It is day zero, and maybe by the time the book comes out, Amazon will be past day two and at day three.
Amazing. Well, Jason, once again, thank you so much for coming on. It's been far overdue, but this is super enlightening. And as Brian said, we will definitely have you back on again soon. Thanks, Jason.
Thanks to you both.
I love everybody.